You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
I have nothing to do with Russia. I said that Putin has much better leadership qualities than Obama, but who doesn't know that?
An actual candidate for the US presidency denies encouraging Russia to interfere in American politics shortly before and indeed after doing exactly that. We'll be attempting to make sense of Donald Trump's latest outburst and observing the confirmation of the first female major party candidate. My guests Mary Dajewski and Tim Marshall will be helping me do that and discussing the day's other top stories, including Greece's diplomatic headache as Turkey demands the return of military officers who sought post-coup asylum, whether or not surprisingly upbeat economic indicators in the UK have a certain mirage-like quality, and if a 50th anniversary is gold, a 60th diamond, and a 70th platinum, is a 100th mountain? Norway seems to think so. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, former diplomatic editor of Sky News, and Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome both. We will get to Trump in due course. It's been a vintage performance, even by his standards. But we will start with Philadelphia and the Democratic National Convention, where last night, in a moment nonetheless important for its inevitability, history was made when a major US political party formally nominated a woman for the presidency of the United States. It is not merely obviously reprehensible that this has taken so long, it's actually kind of incredible, given that it's a full 32 years since the Democrats nominated a female vice presidential candidate. Clinton will, of course, be hoping to improve on the showing of the Walter Mondale-Geraldine Ferraro ticket, which lost 49 states. But last night, her husband, Bill Clinton, was on hand to usher in the achievement, as well as the comedian Lena Dunham. Here they are both speaking.
In the spring of 1971, I met a girl. She had thick blonde hair, big glasses, wore no makeup. And she exuded this sense of strength and self-possession that I found magnetic. For this time, Hillary is uniquely qualified to seize the opportunities and reduce the risk we face. And she is still the best darn change maker I have ever known.
I am a pro-choice, feminist, sexual assault survivor with a chronic reproductive illness. Donald Trump and his party think I should be punished for exercising my constitutional rights. His rhetoric about women takes us back to a time when we were meant to be beautiful and silent. Meanwhile, 22 years ago, Hillary Clinton declared that women's rights are human rights.
Lena Dunham before that, of course, Bill Clinton. Mary, first of all, Hillary Clinton appeared on telescreen to describe her nomination as the biggest crack in the glass ceiling yet. I'm just wondering, it does seem a weird anomaly at this point in American public life, given that women have occupied so many other positions, in fact, almost every other position in American public life. I was looking for some examples. I mean, things that would not happen, I don't think, in many other countries. The current vice chief of U.S. Navy operations, for example, is one Admiral Michelle Howard. Is it just odd and a weird anomalous thing that a woman has not yet been nominated for president, or are there specific reasons for it?
Oh, that's a big question.
I mean,
I certainly felt that there was a moment last night that in a way had somehow escaped us all, because it somehow seemed so absolutely natural that Hillary was going to be the candidate, and we all sort of took it for granted. So it wasn't until yesterday, when she was actually handed the nomination by acclamation, thanks to Bernie Sanders, that, you know, it really struck you that it is actually happening, that she's got this far. But when you say, well, is it extraordinary that a woman hasn't got this far in America until now, then I think on the one hand it is, because, as you say, they've occupied so many, and they were one of the first countries, big countries in the world, to have a female Secretary of State. But I do think there is something about women in America, and, you know, everybody looks at the United States and thinks this is where feminism began. And when I look at it, and having worked and lived in America, I look at it and think it actually was not by chance that feminism began in America, because the United States actually had need of feminism.
You could make the same case about the Civil Rights Act or the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s. It happened there for a reason.
Absolutely. I mean, the sense of sort of conventional, the idealization of the family, all those sort of things, it's so strong in America, and it still is today.
Tim, what do you think? I mean, that is an interesting thought, that despite the fact that America likes to project itself as this place where anybody can do anything, has it weirdly actually been unusually hostile towards women seeking to advance in public life for those reasons that Mary mentioned?
Not uniquely hostile, but it has been hostile, and it's always worth remembering that the America that we watch on television is not always the America that is actually existing. You know, they're called the flyover states because too many visitors go to New York and then fly over the states and go to LA. And in between, there's all sorts of things going on. It is a country which is different in its, for a modern democracy, it is actually a country of extremes, more extremes than most other modern democracies.
Vastly more so, I think.
Yeah. And that therefore plays back into what Mary said. That is why it's taken so long. But the trail has been blazed, partly through feminism, and then partly through, I think it was Madeleine Albright was the first Secretary of State. We went on to have Condoleezza Rice, we've got Susanna Rice's the NSA, etc., etc. And the time is now. And last night she was preceded by Michelle Obama on the stage, and it was just so natural to see this incredibly talented woman and this incredibly talented speech that she gave. So it's still only a crack in the glass ceiling, and she's got a 50-50 chance of shattering it.
Well, we should turn our attention to the man who is still insisting he's going to attempt to prevent her from doing that. Donald Trump's press conference today was remarkable even by his standards. Here is some of it.
I have nothing to do with Russia. I said that Putin has much better leadership qualities than Obama, but who doesn't know that? It's probably not Russia. Nobody knows if it's Russia. You know, the sad thing is that with the technology and the genius we have in this country, not in government, unfortunately, but with the genius we have in government, we don't even know who took the Democratic National Committee emails, right? We don't even know who it is. I heard this morning, one report said they don't think it's Russia. They think it might be China. But if it's any foreign country, it shows how little respect they have for the United States, yes.
Mary, this is deeply strange. Elsewhere in that press conference, Donald Trump actually cheerfully asked Russia to maybe, like, look into Hillary Clinton's emails and find those missing emails, and suggested they would be rewarded for doing so, which is to say we have an actual candidate for President of the United States asking a reasonably hostile foreign power if they would spy on a former Secretary of State on his behalf.
Well, I would say slow down, because although there are people putting it about with apparent authority that it was the Russians and it was Russian military intelligence that did it, I think it is so easy to invoke Russia for all these sort of things.
It's quite often accurate, in fairness.
Well, sometimes it's accurate and sometimes it's not. But the whole of the Remain campaign in the UK during the referendum said that Russia, and Putin in particular, was sitting there egging on the Brexit movement because they wanted to see the European Union ruined.
They weren't displeased by it, were they?
There was absolutely no evidence for any Russian view whatsoever. And the only thing that Putin said very late on was that there were there were pluses and there were minuses to Brexit. That was before it actually happened. And my view is that the minuses, and I think Putin also said that they slightly outweighed the pluses, that the insecurity that Brexit would bring with it, including for Russia, was a huge liability. And so I think you just have to go, you know, it is so easy to blame Russia for everything. And yes, sometimes they do it. Sometimes they don't do it, and they actually rather like the kudos attached with being accused of doing it, which they may do in this case.
Well, it's very easy to imagine that not for the first time Vladimir Putin is witnessing events in the United States and laughing his head off. Tim, I don't even really know what the question I'm trying to ask here is, except how far through the looking glass are we at this point?
There was a film called Brewster's Millions in the 1980s. With Richard Pryor. A pretty funny film. He had to spend $100 million in a month in order to get an even greater reward. I forget what it was. And every, you know, he kept throwing money at these ridiculous projects, you know, certain that they would fail, doing absolutely balmy, crazy things, so there's no way he could succeed. And every single time they started making even more money, he could not get rid of it. You know, and we're so far through the looking glass that you're thinking, is Trump actually trying to say all these mad, crazy things so that the penny will drop and everyone will say, he's a clown, we're not voting for him. But in fact, no, every single time there's another vote. And he just said all that stuff, and I guarantee you the headline tomorrow or tonight will be the one about asking Russia to steal emails and he's going to be a traitor and blah. But, you know, what I hear every time he speaks is, ba-dum-tsh. And that gets you quite a long way in politics. And this is, I was thinking this earlier, the difference between ba-dum-tsh of Trump, and we European liberals hear him and sneer and all the rest of it, whereas in fact the steel workers in Pittsburgh are saying, yeah, absolutely right on, and they're the ones who've got a vote, and we haven't. Set against that, I will give you Michelle Obama's speech, Bernie Sanders' speech, Bill Clinton's speech, Joe Biden, I think he's speaking tonight, and then Hillary Clinton. Now, I don't hold a candle for any of those people, but if you want to talk about serious politicians on the world stage, put that against ba-dum-tsh, and you've got a real 50-50 fight going on.
It is odd. Mary, whether or not the Russians had anything to do with the DNC hack, it is beyond any doubt, because he said it out loud with a camera pointing at him, that Donald Trump actually requested Russia's help in finding Hillary Clinton's missing emails. Is it possible to tell from Russia's point of view whether they would actually welcome a Donald Trump presidency? Because on the one hand, he said today that he would look at recognizing their annexation of Crimea, if indeed he knows where Crimea is. He's been extremely equivocal about his views about NATO's Article 5, about whether he would bother to come to Estonia or Latvia's rescue if Russia pushed its luck. Would Putin, who's clearly not a foolish man, whatever else you may think of him, be looking at Trump and thinking, here is an opportunity to sow immense havoc in the Western world? Or is Putin like everybody else, looking at him and just thinking, oh my God?
No, I think there's actually there's a third option, and this is not that he's thinking, oh my God, or that he is thinking, you know, this is a clown. Or I think he is looking at Trump as a realistic and maybe partly desirable alternative to a Hillary Clinton presidency. I think if you sit in the Kremlin and you look towards the United States, you think, well, relations haven't been too bad, haven't been as bad as this for probably about 10 years, that Hillary Clinton is regarded as being harder line, more in a Cold War mode than Barack Obama, and that Trump at least brings, now you can say it's uninformed thinking, but it is new thinking to the problem.
Well, that's one way of putting it, but also from Russia's point of view, at a brutal, basic, elemental, existential security level, is Putin not actually a little bit concerned that you might as well give the launch codes to a chimpanzee?
I don't think they look at it like that. I think they look at, you know, Trump for a Russian is something half familiar. Somebody who blusters and boasts, somebody who's made enormous sums, maybe in slightly dubious fashions. You know, they wouldn't go so far as that, and I probably shouldn't go that far. But this is, in many ways, this is a familiar character to Russians. And those particular characteristics do not, in Russian terms, bar somebody from power, nor do they mean that when they get to power, they would necessarily use it completely irresponsibly.
Okay, well, we are going to have to move on now, somewhat unfortunately, and look at Turkey. Now, if you are a senior Turkish military officer, and it does sound like they might be hiring, then it is hard to imagine a surer sign that things have gone badly wrong than it feeling like that the smart move, all things considered, is to seek refuge in Greece, of all places. Such, however, was the decision made by eight participants in the other week's abortive coup d'etat, who flew by helicopter to Alexandropolis and are claiming asylum. Now, unsurprisingly, Turkey wants them back. Tim, if you were trying to concoct an immense theoretical diplomatic headache to test the Greek foreign ministry, you'd come up with something a bit like this, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes. And when they landed, there'll be people with their heads in their hands thinking, oh, my God, what do we do now?
Because they can't send them back, can they? These guys claim they will be tortured and or executed, and that would would appear to have a case.
Let's find out. I agree with you. It would be exceptionally difficult for Greece to send them back to Turkey, given that at the moment there are allegations of torture of the people that are being rounded up, given that Turkey has just suspended, temporarily perhaps, its membership of the European Convention on Human Rights, and given that it is threatening to reintroduce the death penalty for people such as that, if indeed they were people in the coup. It's pretty difficult to see how. Against that is they don't want this headache with their giant neighbour, and EU doesn't want this headache with their giant
neighbour.
Indeed
not.
I think the Greeks sentenced the eight soldiers to 2 months' imprisonment for illegal entry, which was sort of quite amusing, but that was simply a way of holding this issue for 2 months while we work out what to do. Push comes to shove, and we're guessing. I can't see them sending them back. It would be regarded in the chambers of the EU and, in fact, by the public as an abject surrender of what it is supposed to be upholding.
Mary, if Greece doesn't send them back, and it does seem like it would be diplomatically, politically, etc., impossible for them to do so, do we anticipate that Recep Tayyip Erdogan's response would be sort of, you know, philosophical, can't win them all, fair enough, what are you going to do, that kind of thing?
Well, you rather suspect that given current circumstances in Turkey, then probably no, because this is going to be a matter for huge national pride. It's going to be very difficult for President Erdogan to make any sort of concessions on their fate whatsoever. He needs them back, and he needs them back for his own political and for Turkish nationalist reasons. And I think in some ways this whole issue highlights the fact that Turkey and Greece are both in NATO. Turkey is not in the EU. Greece is in the EU. That's where, as it were, your quote values agenda comes in. It's going to be very difficult for Greece to hand them back without violating all the things it's signed up to with the EU and the European Court on Human Rights. So all those things say no. But you know, the fact is that Greece and Turkey have some of the worst atmospherics in diplomatic relations of almost any other two countries in Europe.
Just a final thought on this one, Tim. How much creeping nervousness will there be among EU capitals that these eight gentlemen might not be the last eight people who try to seek refuge in Europe from Erdogan's Turkey?
Well, they may well not be, because there are thousands of people on the run at the moment, including journalists, and you know, maybe they can get across. And of course, they're not the only refugees. There will be other refugees who are still going to come. At the moment, it's hard to see in the wider context how the EU-Turkey deal on allowing Turks visas to come to the EU, which is kicked into the medium-term grass and is now being kicked to September. It's hard to see how the EU is going to do that. And so, therefore, the whole refugee agreement may break down.
OK, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dijewski and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, post-Brexit EU-UK economy. Is it really likely to be that bad?
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page, large-format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Mary Dejewski. And let's look now at the UK. And in the build-up to last month's referendum on EU membership, a key plank of the Remain campaign was so-called Project Fear, the idea that Britain's departure would be an act of willful, irresponsible economic self-sabotage. Initial indications immediately following the vote seemed to confirm the threat. The markets tanked, as did the pound. But might this have been an overreaction? Mary, first of all, there's been a bunch of actually quite good sounding news. The pound is still in the sink, but the markets are back to where they were, more or less. Or is that just because the pound is still in the sink and everything's very cheap?
Yes, well, I was going to say that there is possibly a connection between some of the economic good news in terms of companies being bought and sold and people investing and the parlous state of the pound. But I have another impression when I listen to this news. And you're not supposed to think this about British news because you think that it's basically straight reporting. But I have this horrible sense of spin when I hear all this sort of spate of supposedly good news. And it's almost as though things have been sort of held back and are being sort of encouraged and are being presented in a very conscious way to sort of boost morale and encourage the others. And I have to say that I take a slightly sceptical view of it.
What do you think, Tim? Because the headline today was that the GDP results for the second quarter of this year were better than expected, up 0.6%.
Well, that's obviously
before the vote.
That is why I don't agree with Mary. There's something about Mary, and I disagree with it. Look, this idea of spin. If the last quarter coming up to the vote had been much, much worse, that would have been equally reported. All the economic figures that are coming out would have been reported in the same manner. Now, I argued on the 24th, let's not panic. It's not going to be as bad as everybody thinks. But what happens is from day one after the vote, if you are for Brexit, you seize on every piece of good news and you say, I told you so. If you are against Brexit, you seize on every bit of bad news and you say, I told you so. Whereas, you know, if you're trying to actually look at where it's really going, you have to not be biased one way or the other and weigh all the different news that is coming out. And for every positive, I will give you a negative.
But isn't that...
And vice versa.
And you're not wrong, but isn't that an inevitable result of, you know, all political discourse in democracies is adversarial. Nobody campaigning on either...
But exactly, politics, not economics.
Well, indeed, but still nobody campaigning on either side in the referendum was going to go, you know what, everybody, whatever the result, water's still going to come out of the taps, the sun will still come up.
No, but afterwards is when you can say that.
Yes, but this supposedly good news that was presented to us today, that the economy was doing superbly well in the run-up to the referendum
vote... Not superbly well. A growth of 0.6, a reasonable growth...
In one quarter, that's not bad.
More than what was expected and what was catered for. And this is being presented sort of after the fact as, you know, the Brits really weren't, nobody was panicking in the run-up to the referendum. Well, you know, this is not a realistic figure for now without having the figures, which we don't obviously have yet, for the next 3 months.
I agree with you. We have to wait for several quarters and then make a better judgment. But the point I'm making is I don't see in any way how it is spun. If it had been -4, it would have been a headline.
It's not about those particular figures being spun. What I was talking about is this sort of series of investment decisions and the announcement that GSK is going to have this, going to have a great new investment in the UK.
£275 million
hasn't pulled out, and so, you know, this is happening and that's happening, and always with a little sort of coda that says, "There you see, Brexit doesn't make any difference." Well, I'm not sure that we know that yet.
Of course, it makes a massive difference. But again, I go back to the original point. Every single time you put a positive, somebody else would say, "Oh, what about the negative?" And vice versa. I mean, when the FTSE fell and the 250 fell, everybody said it's the end of the world, run for the hills and put your underpants over your head.
They fell back to where they'd been about 6 months previously.
And then it came, it's actually, the FTSE is actually above where it was a year ago. Now, I'm not using that to say, look, it's all going to be all right. I'm using that to say we've got to stop looking at the subject from our political perspective of what we might want to happen and want to be true because I told you so, and look at it simply in the round. And at the moment, the jury's out and it might be okay. And it might not, but I don't think the world's going to come to an end yet.
But, Tim, there's nothing more fun than saying, yeah, I told you so.
Well, don't do it with economics, because it matters.
Well, we should move on, finally, tonight. Looking ahead to this December the 6th, which will mark the 100th anniversary of Finland's declaration of independence from Russia. Now, possibly in one of those joint Christmas present scenarios, which those of us born in December are wearily familiar with, Norway is considering marking the occasion by presenting Finland with a mountain, the peak of Holtby, currently just inside Norway's border. It would become Finland's highest point. Now, Mary, first of all, it seems like a nice gesture, really, until you actually do a bit of research, and, you know, I did a bit of research. Holti is not even in the top 200 of Norway's mountain peaks. Is this a bit of Norway going, we've got to get them something, we've got loads of these, whatever, they can have that. See if we care.
I think it's actually quite adventurous by Norway, because even changing borders is one of these taboos.
And it does involve a redrawing of the border.
Absolutely. And changing borders is one of these taboos. And even if you're talking about it, you know, a few yards to put a summit, even a small summit of a small mountain in somebody else's territory, even if you do it by mutual agreement, this is still, it sort of sets quite difficult precedents. But I have to say that, you know, on the other hand, I do rather like it. I mean, it seems to be such a quintessentially Nordic sort of feel-good, social, you know, social market, all those sorts of things.
I'm still put a bit in mind of, I always laugh when I walk past the big statue of Queen Victoria in Sydney, which has a big plaque on the bottom saying it's a gift to the people of New South Wales from the people of Ireland. And of course, what happened was the thing was built, it was installed in Ireland in 1908. I think it was taken down after the Civil War. The Irish spent decades trying to get rid of the thing and finally found a sucker in Australia in the 1980s.
You're not comparing like with like. This is a fabulous good news story. I don't think it does have that much international repercussions. However, imagine if you'd taken this approach to Alsace-Lorraine, Sudetenland, the Crimea. Yes. Now, okay, it has to. Your border moves 200 metres.
Not even going to talk about Israel and Palestine.
Let's not. At that point, Norway loses 0.015 square kilometres. But what they gain is the love of the entire world that they gave a little mountain to a country that hasn't got any mountains. And I agree with Mary, for once. What a lovely, lovely gesture, and it is so Nordic.
You don't think there's any concern at all about promoting the idea that national borders are that malleable, that they can be altered on whim? I mean, but, you know, people have actually gone to war over less.
It's an inspiration to us all that will not inspire the hard realpolitik that will kick in when it comes to Crimea.
And maybe it's also a precedent to say that actually changing borders can sometimes, not always, but sometimes be a good thing.
So you're suggesting that Russia will heartily endorse this plan?
Russia has been one of the most fervent opponents of changing borders until it decided that it was in its interest.
Have you been to Finland?
I have, yes.
It's flat.
It's very flat.
Oh my goodness, it's flat.
And if you stand in roughly the middle of it, you can see the entire country.
Yeah. And you can see Russia from there as well, as Sarah Palin once said.
I'm sure you get a better view from the top of the new mountain.
Well, it's not even that big. It's a lovely, lovely story about two neighbouring countries that get on nearly always absolutely fine with each other. It's a wonderful, wonderful gesture. It shows us how things can be.
Mary, finally, do you think it's likely to catch on?
Well, I doubt very much whether it would translate far beyond the Nordic world, but so long as it survives there, then I think it is an example to us all.
Mary Dejewski and Tim Marshall, thank you both very much as ever for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Jimena Mignan and Jacob Laderna. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. There's music next with Carlotta Ribello. At 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.